Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting, so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
Here we are on the 17th of December. Cold day in the middle of December, and the cold winds are blowing in Washington too. I think the president keeps telling us how he never breaks any laws, but he seems to have adopted Richard Nixon's notion that when the president does it, it's not illegal, and it's a self-sealing system, as far as I can tell. The same system we were getting about torture. When the U.S. does it, it's not torture, and what the U.S. does isn't torture, so it works out okay.
Little detail from those days when Rehnquist was Solicitor General, I believed he was something in the...
I think that's right.
Nixon White House, he wrote a memo that suggested that common law right of the monarch protected his wiretapping activities. So that there was this legacy outside the extra-constitutional authority from the right of the monarch, which is still amazing that he could actually offer that, but they were grasping at straws to defend their outright illegal activity. They say Bush's radio address, which I happen to hear, has got to be heard or read to be believed. He claims that they had 45-day reviews of this special orders to the NSA, and that they consulted at least a dozen times with people in the Congress. However, not apparently the chair of the Judiciary Committee. Spector called it outright. I don't know. Used very undiplomatic, unpolitician sounding words to describe it as almost outrightly calling it an illegal activity.
Yeah,
not invoke any kind of court supervision for a wiretap order.
Interesting. We maybe get back to the great days of the Church Committee and the investigations of the sorts of things that put the laws in place that these folks are busily dismantling. That'd be great.
How far can the man go in the Judiciary Committee without first reining him in, though, I wonder?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Frist is making such an ass of himself on so many fronts and is in such trouble himself that I'm not sure how much trouble he have, how much control he really has over these matters.
His statement after the failure of the cloture vote of the Patriot Act was had another thing that had to be heard to believe that he wouldn't countenance any extensions because obviously these people who are criticizing the Patriot Act couldn't be seriously offering that they want to extend it. When, you know, the whole thing about extending it is so they can go home for the holidays.
That's basically odd, isn't it? I mean, I was actually a little surprised at that. What we're talking about here, in fact, is the fact that the Patriot Act came up for reauthorization and it was passed by the House. The House, including a no vote by our own representative, Timothy Johnson, I was happy to see. But the House did pass it. It goes to the Senate, and there a group of senators said they would filibuster it. The vote to shut off the filibuster required 60 votes. And they only got 52, so that was a fairly large gap. They could not shut off the filibuster, which means that the authorization could not come to a vote. But it had been talked about all along that a three-month extension of the Patriot Act under the present arrangement would be acceptable to the folks who were objecting, with the grounds that, with the understanding that in that 3 months they work out the details, and work out the things that were being objected to. Why did the White House say no to the three-month extension? As it stands, some aspects of the Patriot Act lapse in 2 weeks.
Right. Well, we've been caught, you know, they're in the ironic position, or the satiric position, satirizable position of arguing that these people are holding these provisions that are so essentially important, and whereas the White House is apparently just trying to use it as a political issue. So they're holding it, letting it elapse so that they can use it as a political campaign issue in the future, which is really bizarre. You know, if it's so ultra important for our national security,
well,
you can't let mere politics, as it were. But that's not the Rovian school.
Well, it's important for national security. I mean, the ACLU, for example, has objected to a provision in the act that, according to one interpretation, makes holding an unauthorized sign at an event, quote, designated by the Secret Service as a national special security event, a felony punishable by a year imprisonment. Mm-hmm. Now, that's very interesting. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that, you know, makes you think that one of the real reasons the White House wants the Patriot Act is to deal with its real enemy, that is the American people. The only enemy this government really fears, is that that is constituted by the American populace when they decide that the administration has definitely done something substantially wrong, and they want to be able to stop that. So
that
could be interesting.
You wonder if these international wiretap calls that were monitored might have included some key words that had to do with demonstrations against such as the WTO or the IMF.
That's a very interesting question.
International levels.
So. Absolutely.
What? Yeah, I would
connect
be surprised.
That. Yeah, I mean, with major demonstrations going on right now in Hong Kong against the WTO there, I mean, seems like a separate story. But you may be onto something there, Paul. It may be, you know, the sorts of thing. They certainly believe the old SDS mantra in Washington that everything is connected, and these NSA intercepts, this spying by the National Security Agency on American citizens, authorized by this administration, has ruffled some feathers. People are upset about this, and the administration's reasons for doing it may well be the sort of thing you suggest.
Pre-9/1, some people allege, I don't know how they can do the documentation of it, that there were more FBI people investigating anti-corporate globalization people than there were investigating Al-Qaeda.
I've heard that too.
So, you know, that's the Bush priorities.
Well, this is, I mean, I've said for a while there's a real struggle in the heart of the Bush administration between looters and killers, the killers being the neocons who wanted to project the army into the Middle East, and the looters who wanted to enrich the base being, of course, the very rich that that this president has always represented, and that indeed there are occasions when their interests clash. They're not the same, and I think in the disarray of the second Bush administration, we're seeing some of that clash.
Cheney's visit to around the world coming up right now, makes it pretty clear that I don't think he'll be casting a deciding vote in the Senate anytime soon. I guess maybe he'll be casting a deciding vote in the Afghan parliament because he's going to attend the opening ceremony there. I guess we've already cast it by proxy anyway, so or made the deciding vote by proxy already. So you endured the Jim Lehrer Hour interview with Bush last night, I understand.
I did, yeah. I don't normally do that, but last night I did hear it. It was very interesting, very strange, in that Bush says, well, I can't talk about ongoing security investigations and so forth, refused really to talk about big story of the week, that is the New York Times breaking the story, which they had been sitting on for a year.
Really?
Of the NSA doing thousands of wiretaps, and immediately Lehrer says, oh, that's the big story of the week. Bush says, no, it isn't. The big story is the election in Iraq. And Lehrer says, oh, yes, of course, I know that. The big story is the election. But, I mean, it was an interesting example of management.
We'll get to that.
Of news management, the way in which the administration is very much concerned about what things are presented and how, and what a real smack in the face it is for the administration to have its supposed triumph in the Iraq elections be upstaged by this revelation in the New York Times. Trying to figure this out, Paul, who's interests are being served and why the various parties are acting the way they did is really quite difficult. Why, for example, do you think that the New York Times sat on this story for a year? It would have made a big difference, say, during the campaign. Why did they sit on the story for a year? And then why did they choose to stop sitting on it this week? What's going on there?
Yeah, well, it looks like they wanted to affect the vote on the Patriot Act, and they apparently did it. But yeah, the point why did they sit on it so damn long?
Well, and there was interesting, there was a small note a week ago, there was a shake up in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. They've been replacing people in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and people in the Washington Bureau have been firing their assistants right and left. So it argues at least there's some sort of argument going on there. One simple motive is that the New York Times, after all the bad publicity around the propaganda in the run-up to the war, simply wanted to show its good faith by publishing finally a story that they should have published a long time ago. But that's pretty weak. I find that difficult to understand, given the political proclivities of the editors of the New York Times, Bill Keller, notably the executive editor.
When did Keller take over for Raines?
A little more than a year ago.
So the question is when did they get that story, and was it part of the lost in the shuffle of the interregnum, or who made the decision?
Keller gave an interview to the Washington Post about it. He says they've been talking to the government about it for a year, and indeed they have withheld some material that they have. Right-wing websites are busily saying, aha, the New York Times is publishing a book on this subject. The Free Press is publishing his name is Risen, I think, the reporter who led this story. His book is coming out this week, and the New York Times article didn't mention that, and the book is, this is a major incident in the book. The book is about the CIA and the Bush War in the Middle East. So they're publishing tie-ins here, but still, that's not enough. It gets more and more complicated when we compare the Washington Post big scoop. They scooped the Times on this, too. Of some weeks ago about the secret CIA prisons in Europe and elsewhere. It's been suggested that the CIA itself was behind that revelation, and it certainly is the case the Washington Post has been the CIA's conduit, or the conduit of at least some elements within the CIA all along. So are what we're dealing with here, some sort of counter-move by the CIA's enemies in Washington, and remember the CIA's enemies in Washington are down the Potomac a little ways in the Pentagon, and it gets more and more difficult.
CIA rivalries.
Well, or rivalries of various groups saying that it's time to it's time to leave the sinking ship, or indeed to help the ship sink a little more, too. Remember, even back at the time of Watergate, there were suggestions, and suggestions that I always thought had something to them, that part of the Watergate imbroglio was the attempt by various elements within the CIA and elsewhere to weaken, to undermine, or even to bring down the Nixon presidency because of the madness that they thought was occurring in the White House. Do we have a replay of that going on right now? Mm. I'm not sure. We certainly know that the Bush administration has tried to make the CIA a whipping boy for everything that's gone wrong, and that there is very bad blood between the sort of traditional elements in the CIA and the Bush administration. First of all, because the CIA wouldn't pony up the stories that the Bush administration wanted to go into to the Middle East with, and therefore they had to construct their own intelligence, and they worked around it through Pentagon offices and the vice president browbeating people in the CIA and so forth. So the bad blood is there. It's more obvious. It's deeper, perhaps, than it was in the Nixon administration. I'm certainly not trying to make any heroes out of the CIA. No. I am trying to understand, when you read stories like this NSA revelation by the New York Times this week, always the first question you should ask is, why is this being published now? Whose interests are served by its revelation? What's actually going on here in the conditions of the apparition of this story?
The NSA, there's a story, and I don't know if it was in the original New York Times story, I can't remember it anymore, that some people in the NSA wouldn't cooperate with this procedure. They wanted,
exactly.
They wanted to have government, they wanted to have a court, FISA court. FISA is appointed by the Supreme Court head chief, so
yep.
So Roberts gets to appoint that. There are some people saying that that's a bad, accumulating too much power in the court, but that's another issue. But
well, the FISA court.
They whoever they are, we... nine-person secret court.
We know
that
some
the
of the
NSA
names.
Actually put the operation on hiatus for a short period too. They somebody, maybe there was a change in command. I don't know. They wanted to review whether they could do it or not at some point too. So there was obviously some dissension inside the NSA itself.
Yes, I think you're right about that. And I wouldn't put it all. I mean, when we have this sort of things within the secret agencies of the government, the practice has been frequently for these folks to go to a reporter and to out the things that are going on. As I say, that's been suggested that's what's going on, that the CIA wants out of the foreign prison come torture business, and that they were the ones who outed it. Well, perhaps that's true. The NSA thing, though, gets curiouser and curiouser. You mentioned the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act courts.
Surveillance.
These, surveillance, right. Foreign Intelligence and Surveillance Act, is that how it goes?
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance. They're supposedly surveilling spies.
Don't they? Didn't anyone ever tell them that you don't use nouns to modify other nouns?
Mm.
Well, in any case, the FISA courts has never turned down a request for NSA survey, with one exception. And the one time they turned down a request, it went to the FISA Appeals Court, and the FISA Appeals Court immediately granted it. So the secret agencies are batting 1,000 in terms of the FISA Court. So it's a fig leaf at best. This came out of the Church Committee in 1978 in an attempt to establish some sort of control over these secret agencies. Well, the control was pretty weak. Why then did they have to ignore it? Did the Bush administration have to ignore it, as they apparently have? What's going on there?
It's a separate issue from Patriot Act, but there's some provisions of the Patriot Act that also rely on the FISA court and or something similar. I don't know if it's exactly the same court. But one of the provisions of the new Patriot Act was supposedly just going to make that administrative, so they could just that was also not going to any court at all, even if it's a rubber stamping court. I heard this John Pike guy, who was formerly with the Federation of American Scientists. He's a real tool. He was very, very very, very partial to the Bush administration, saying some ridiculous things on the BBC. He's now with globalsecurity.org, his own outfit. He apparently got asked to resign from the Federation of American Scientists. I don't know if it's because he is so partial to power, but he was saying that, you know, this had to be done because of, you know, what if you find a leak that's immediate? Well, the provisions of the FISA courts protocols say that if you do have an emergency, you have 36 hours. You can start the wiretapping, their surveillance immediately, and then just within 36 hours, you're supposed to get to the court. So the idea that this had to be done because of some kind of immediacy is rubbish. Bush, again, on his radio address today, was talking about how it's been reviewed and reviewed and reviewed. He re-signs the declaration 24 times or something. And it's gone to the Senate. Some people in the Senate, maybe Frist. I don't know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
12 times to reauthorize this. It's amazing. And all of the reviews that he talked about are completely internal reviews, so that they don't even have a fig leaf of being some kind of outside court, which is supposed to be isolated from the administration, which, again, is kind of a joke in itself, given how the fact, as you say, they only turned down one of these in the whole history of it since the mid-70s, right?
That's what it was. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So in the late 70s, that's right. Mm-hmm. I used to have a cartoon taped to my door from the New Masses in the 30s of this soft bed boudoir with this disgusting monster sitting in the bed very carefully looking under its right arm. And the caption was, "The system examines itself." Well, it seems to me that what we're dealing with in most of these things is system examining itself, too, and not to anybody's surprise, coming up with a clean bill of health for what the administration does. What do you make, for example, of the supposed agreement between the White House and Senator McCain on the torture amendment?
Yeah, well.
I mean, several of the papers, even the foreign papers, presented as Bush caves in the Senate, Bush caves in the McCain, torture amendment to pass, et cetera, et cetera. There are other people who say that, on the contrary, this is another example of the same sort of rhetoric the administration uses. We don't do torture because we've defined torture in such a careful way that we hurt people a lot, but we don't call that torture. The president doesn't do anything illegal because we defined legal so carefully that anything the president does is legal. The torture I'm worried that this so-called compromise with McCain, or the White House giving in to McCain, is not that at all. It's another example of their sticking in a loophole big enough for the U.S., for the military and the spy agencies to continue to do what they've been doing all along, is torture policy.
I think they'll probably just do it in the black prisons and we'll never hear about it. But the language does include, does go beyond torture. It goes into what are the other three nouns? I don't know if it includes humiliating, but it does go beyond. It does say things. Doesn't just leave it to torture.
But the problem is, after it says that, it says that it has a reasonable person exception. In other words, indemnifies those American agents who act with the reasonable understanding that they're acting in accordance with the interests of the United States. Language
as
of that
if
sort.
They didn't read the.
So yeah,
they weren't trained. They were trained not to read the read the law that pertains to their activity.
But it's a hole big enough to drive a semi through. I mean, to drive an entire torture operation through. They're going to go on and do what they're doing, and if they should ever be called into question about it, then the answer, if their action should ever be called into question, the answer is, well, they were doing what a reasonable person would do in order to protect the United States of America. Same thing Bush is saying in his rhetoric, in these speeches and these television interviews he's been doing at such a remarkable rate in the last week and two.
There is another amendment alongside of this amendment that allows for torture testimony to be used legally, which is another out.
Isn't that incredible?
If you have this division of Lockheed Martin called Cytex, if I recall, these are some of the independent contractors who specialize in quote unquote interrogation. So this other amendment allows that if they got the evidence, it would be okay to go ahead and use it.
Isn't that incredible? That's right. I mean, they're outsourcing torture here and saying, well, we did not torture anybody. Of course, these folks we hired from California, they did the torture, and they did it in Poland. And here's the vital information they got out of it, vital information like that stuff they got from the guy in Egypt on the connections between al-Qaeda and Iraq. You know,
the language that Conda used was a little more nuanced than Bush. Maybe we should expect that. She never categorically said that it was against the law. She said it was not our policy.
Not our policy,
so
exactly.
If it's not our policy, that means that the government doesn't do it as a matter of policy. But does that
but
mean that Cytex, we can hire Cytex to do
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Or whatever,
that's right.
Whomever.
That's right.
Yeah, speaking of the interview, I mentioned the Colombian. We should talk about that a bit more. I think I mentioned it on the air. But the thing, even the relatively docile Jim Lehrer comments on the irony between Bush's comments on delay will be proved innocent.
Yeah.
Compared to how careful he is not to say anything about an ongoing jurisprudential activity, whatever, concerning the CIA leak. And Bush says, "Well, I didn't say that. I said that everybody should have a right to presumption of innocence." And Lehrer rises and says, "Well, I read your text carefully, and it." That isn't, you know, he didn't contradict him directly. He managed to say it in a way that it didn't seem to imply that. And he said, "That's what you mean now, right?" So he gave him the out of saying, "Well, I just misspoke, and I guess everybody's supposed to believe that or something." Apparently, that was one of the most blogged about things of the week was Bush absolving delay in advance while not talking about other judicial proceedings that that are going after. People in his own administration.
Well, I mean, how do you read the effect of things like the Lehrer interview? And he did what, three television interviews for three different networks? He's done three or four speeches now, and he's going to do another speech tomorrow night, apparently, from the Oval Office. The first time we've had a speech from the Oval Office since the invasion of Iraq. I don't know. Is he going to announce the invasion of Iran tomorrow night, you think, Paul?
The radio address we mentioned, which is centered about defending himself on this NSA usage, was supposed to have been, you know, celebratory about the election, and apparently they bumped that, and now they're asking for prime time, 8 o'clock our time tomorrow. I think he'll just regurgitate pretty much what he said the last couple of times.
I hope
you're curious
right.
Whether he uses as much language as he did today about the how this is all for your own good and your protection and imperial. Prosecution of the war justifies everything.
Well, the line is, the new speechwriter in the White House, apparently his line is, use the word victory as often as possible. That, we say that we're in this for victory, and therefore, by definition, everybody who's not with us is for some form of defeat, you see. That's right. That's the rhetorical ploy that they're using. I don't know. There's also, I think, a notion in the White House that... with the exception of you, the White House gets a different audience for its radio talks on Saturday and these primetime television discussions, that they reach different people. It's worthwhile to compare how they choose to present their increasingly tattered case in that regard. I mean, the polls, people keep saying, oh, yes, well, his numbers in the polls are improving slightly. But, it's all within the margin of error, and it doesn't look like there's much going on there.
Yeah,
that the campaign is not being very effective.
House Democrats wanted to congratulate the courage of the Iraqis for their election yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
And Republicans decided, no, let's do a victory in Iraq resolution. Mm-hmm. So they claimed I guess their pollsters also, their focus groups show that victory tests well in the U.S., Yeah, right.
Well, and as a result, we get another resolution from the House of Representatives calling for victory with a fairly good abstention rate on the other side. That's, once again, the question is, how helpful is this? I mean, the Republicans can get a majority for a jingoistic resolution like that is not surprising. What is surprising and interesting and worthwhile is the number of congressional sheeple who actually go over to the other side of the fold. And either by not voting or actually voting against it. And the numbers were fairly good on that. So, okay. Look, the White House can read the polls, too. They're worried. They're very worried. That's what this whole Bush charm offensive is about, and why Bush is on the television as often as he is. They have obviously good reason to be worried. So one can only hope that... the effects of this thing are as of these activities are as limited as they seem to be.
I think we're going to contend here a little bit. It's related to the economy. Last week we left off talking about Montreal and the Kyoto UN agreement, and I think the real story about that was, as far as Clinton's address, was the fact that the White House was bending flexing their muscle in a big way to not let that happen.
Calling in their markers, yeah.
And it wasn't successful. And I watched all of Clinton's address on the BBC website. You can find it there. And you claim that he was lying, and when he said that it was flat out wrong that Kyoto and the climate business was bad for business.
Yeah.
And I think he's right. I think he served his point. It's bad for some businesses now, but it isn't necessarily intrinsically bad for the economy. There are a lot of groups and environmentally sensitive, you know, windmill producers, et cetera, that would benefit from this. So it's not bad for business in any kind of abstract way. It's bad for some businesses, like the oil companies, who I'm quite happy to see if it was bad for them. So I think to pick on that as a lie, I'm not the defender of Clinton. I think the most outrageous thing that he ever said was after his surgery and he got all this attention, he was asked by, I think, the late Peter Jennings, who he'd like to meet in the world. And he said he'd like to meet the new president of Kenya, because he was extending free education to all children in the whole country. I think it was Kenya. I'm not sure at what point it was. But this from the man who, with his Treasury Secretary and his IMF policies, etc., was responsible for, jointly with other business interests and other structural adjustment advocates, of instituting fee for education service and medical stuff. So, I'm no apologist for him, but to pick that out and call that a lie when it's an arguable point, and I think he actually made the case fairly well that, you can run an economy without burning as much fossil fuel as we are, and eventually none at all.
Well, let's review the bidding here and see what actually was said. The Bush administration was contending that observance of the Kyoto limits would be bad for American business. It seems to me that that's obviously true, in the sense that American business, because the business that the Bush administration is talking about is American big business, profits from the externality of being able to dump its pollution into the air and the water and not have to worry about it. In fact, the environmental movement for more than a generation now has been an attempt to try to impose costs on American business for the polluting activities that they do. Well, the Bush administration says, look, this Kyoto thing does the same thing, and it will be costly for American business. Clinton stands up and says, no, it won't. We could observe Kyoto without its being costly to American business. That is a flat-out lie. It's a flat-out lie because of the way American business has been acting, because American business has made money from the externality, from using the air and the water for its pollution. So it's certainly the case that the Bush administration is looking out for the interest of its base, and what Clinton says is a classic piece of Clinton triangulation, as it was called in his time, that is, lying about the facts in order to take a position that is seen to be progressive. It's not.
You're accepting Thatcher's TIA. There is no alternative.
I didn't. Nothing I said even implies anything close to there is no. Of course there's an alternative.
And that's what he said in his speech. He said it is not necessary. You can make money by complying with Kyoto. And for one, he's the guy that instituted it as a which I object to, this carbon trading thing, which are people are making money on.
Absolutely.
It was an irony to find out that Bush in his famous talk about where we're gonna do better than Kyoto but we're not gonna comply to it. He actually offered big business some kind of escrow vouchers for the equivalent amount of money that they would save. So he was like supposedly saying that they were going to hedge their bets, but he never instituted it. And there are a lot of people in the conservative realm that are actually worried about this. They're actually thinking that Kyoto might go forward, and the fact that Bush hasn't called for these bailout escrow credits paid for apparently by the taxpayer, another subsidy of big business. But so I object to the way the Kyoto is set up. But intrinsically, the argument that Clinton made was that it doesn't have to be bad for business. It's not.
And that's
not true.
Patently false. What we're trying to do by reducing pollution, what we're trying to do by the whole movement of anti-corporate globalization, is impose greater costs on business to prevent them from doing the sorts of things that they are doing that are dangerous to to the environment and to humanity. And it's Clinton. I mean, the Democrats, as usual, working for their friends in big business, are trying to say they're there, everything will be okay, we can make everyone comfortable here, and it really won't do any damage to anyone. These are flat out lies.
No,
what we're getting from what we're getting from the Bush administration, as usual, is vicious, but it's fairly honest. They were honest about how they wanted to kill people in the Middle East. They're honest about how they want to enrich themselves from the economy as a whole. Another example, Paul, of when
let me just finish the sentence. I want to talk about what you just said. It is not necessarily true that this is bad for business. It's bad for the oil companies. It's bad for the current setup. That is not intrinsically bad for business. There are other businesses that can gain from this. And so it's just ridiculous to take a nuanced point, a complicated issue, and just say it's a lie, because it isn't a lie.
A nuanced point is an example of classic Clinton misdirection. Mm-hmm. And it depends upon what the meaning of is, as Clinton says. This is the sort of thing that he's done all along. He has obfuscated matters by saying, we're going to do something good, we're going to do something worthwhile. Nothing in Kyoto will hurt business, says Clinton. Well, if it won't, then it isn't worth doing. The whole point is to hurt business.
No, it isn't. It's to change business. It's to change the economy.
Well,
it's not.
Depends upon what you mean by business, huh? What the definition of
business
is.
You're accepting the definition of business as it exists now, and you're saying I'm only looking at the ones that Bush is representing. Well, that's not the only businesses in the world, so it's absurd to call it just to say that it's a lie. I'm in the position of defending someone who I think is not defensible on a lot of issues, but occasionally even us, even yuppie scum like his says something that is actually true, though he doesn't define much as yuppie scum.
Certainly that's
safe,
true.
Legal and rare, I think, is another good.
Certainly that's true, but in this case he certainly hasn't. When we hear the word economy, in the mouths of people like Clinton, any of our politicians, we should always read the profits of rich people, i.e. the economy is doing better, this will help the economy, so forth and so on, because that's what their interests are. An interesting set of figures turned up this week about hinwees, a phrase that's used, I've heard it before from bankers and others. Hinwees are people with at least $1 million of investable assets. Hinwee stands for high net worth individuals. Now, to be a high net worth individual, you have to have $1 million of investable assets. So, I mean, for example, Paul, the vastly valuable Muth Manor in Urbana, if all your money's sunk into that, then you don't qualify as a Hinwee because your million dollar
South Prospect. Yeah,
well, exactly. These aren't investable amounts. I mean, we live in them, and therefore this is not investable amount. We have to have assets over and above, that sort of thing to be a Hinwee. Okay, there are, to my amazement, only 8.3 million people of this sort in the world. My source is a long article in the Financial Times last week, and it's quite interesting on this. 8.3 million, that's all out of 6.5 billion human beings. 8.3 million of them are Hinwees. They've got $1 million or more to invest. But what's even more interesting, first, the number has grown by 60% in the last 7 years. There are 60% more Hinwees than there were, and that's not all inflation by any means. As a group, that mere 8.3 million people own over $30 trillion of investable assets. Now, the gap between rich and poor in the world is quite wide and growing, but so is the gap. The curve continues to go up to remarkable rates. The gap between the rich and the super rich, the gap amongst the Hinwees, is quite great. The super rich are less than 10% of those 8.3 million, in other words, about 820,000 people, and they own one half of that wealth, $15.4 trillion in the hand of 820,000 people in the world, Paul. I mean, this is a, just staggering maldistribution of the wealth of the world, and we wonder why we have problems and that, there are a great deal of interests out there protecting the wealth of the very few. They have an awful lot of it, and they will go to any lengths to protect it.
Yeah, I do. I guess I didn't sleep through an hour after all. They had a segment about the $95 billion of tax relief over the next few years with this investment dividend forgiveness tax and capital gains, I guess, also was in that. And pointed out that most people get zero from that, and
right.
people that do get it get $17,000. They had a rich fellow on who once was with this group that didn't want the so-called death tax
yeah.
to be passed, and pointed out that you know, this is absurd, and you know, for people that are in the Hinwee category, $17,000 doesn't really
right.
What does it do for them?
It's walking around money. Yeah.
yeah.
The death tax thing is interesting to see. I think it's another sign of the disarray the Bush administration is in, that they haven't been able to complete that particular theft that they've been working on for a while.
It's still sunsetting, huh?
Exactly. It is. And I actually said something nice about our congressional representative a little while ago because of a vote that he had cast in the House of Representatives. But I did see his Christmas time publicity. Telling about all the wonderful things he's done to his constituents, has in a prominent place voted against the death tax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, you've talked about this before, but I mean, this seems to me to be the one of the biggest misrepresentations we've got going on right now. And one of the things that if we really thought about our politics, you know, we would realize that the sorts of taxes on wealth that hardly exist in this country have got to be a way for us to rethink the tax system. We have a system now that makes the rich rich and the poor poorer, and the gap in American society is growing every day. And sooner or later, something's got to be done about it. Our politics are motivated by that gap, the maintenance of that gap, and the defense of the wealth of the very rich in this country.
Yeah. I have a curious digression to make. The Venezuelan consul from Chicago's talk on campus, the ambassador from D.C., the ambassador to the U.S. from Venezuela, was fogged out of central Illinois, had to land in St. Louis. But the young man from Chicago who was going to greet him here, a Venezuelan fellow, was quite eloquent. And one thing he pointed out that Chavez had told him was that he was talking about microcredit and the microcredit to cooperatives and small businesses that they have going on in Venezuela. And he's pointing out that the statistics are that rich people default on more loans than poor people do.
Mm-hmm.
Poor people maybe they're more under the thumb or something, and mm-hmm. they don't have good lawyers to declare bankruptcy, particularly with the new laws. But statistically, it's true that rich have a better redemption rate for their loans, amortization than the poor have a better statistic.
Well, this is an important thing. I mean, the what's going on in Venezuela. I mean, I've said for a while that if the Bush administration had not made such an incredible hash of the invasion of Iraq, that the 82nd Airborne would be in Caracas now. I mean, the U.S. is deeply worried about what's happening in the Andean region in South America, and they really are working very hard behind the scenes to try to undermine this growing popular movement throughout South America. There's an election in Bolivia this Sunday that will probably be won by this man, Evo Morales, who is an Indian, and he'll be the first Indian to hold office in Bolivia since independence of Bolivia in 1825, and he scares them to death in Washington. One among other things, he said, "Well, they've got to make the coca trade legal."
And, well, he wants it to be legally internal. It's kind of what they're going to do in Holland, maybe, which is to make growing legal there. But they won't allow it to be sold across the border.
And
Morales says the same thing. He actually said that when he's elected, he's going to be one of the U.S.'s worst nightmares.
Exactly.
So
he knows what his position
is. School of winning the election by insulting the the Great White Father to the north.
Well, we laugh about this, but I mean, in fact, you know, this is very worrisome, and the U.S. is capable of an awful lot here in the in the interest of the people we were just talking about. In Argentina, the other end of the continent, so to speak, there's a rather remarkable thing has happened. Argentina is just about to pay off its loans after a tremendous collapse that was a result of the Argentina being the fair-haired child of the International Monetary Fund and having its economy go to hell as a result. They've crawled out of that by ignoring the international financial institutions, and their prosperity is such that they're now they're in a position to get out from under them. I mean, this is an amazing operation, which shows up what's been said by a lot of people for a long time, that the international financial institutions are not there to aid the development of the rest of the world. They're there to control the economy of the rest of the world in the interest of the United States, and indeed in the interest of rich people in the United States. And here we have a walking, talking example in Argentina, and the example is not lost on the rest of the continent, indeed on the rest of the world.
They defaulted on the loan of the IMF
and
refused to follow the policies,
and
now they're going to get the IMF off their back entirely. Argentine, prior to World War II, was one of, by some calculus, the fifth richest country in the world, and I think they actually know that they didn't do well by the whole post-Bretton Woods economic system, the Washington consensus and everything.
That's
else.
Right.
So it is worrisome for them. I think we should talk about Colombia. Bush mentioned used Colombia as
didn't he?
Analogized Iraq to Colombia, which is pretty strange since
there's been
a 30-year war there.
And you both of us were in the uncomfortable position of actually praising some of the questions from Lara on PBS. Lara immediately said, does that mean we're going to have troops in Iraq as long as we've had troops in Colombia?
Mm.
Which is an interesting question.
I actually don't remember him saying our troops, people don't know that the other place in the world where we have a big number of military contractors is Colombia. Something I learned at the Venezuela.
Interesting point. I think what Lara actually said, fighting has been going on there for 10 or 15 years. Do you mean fighting will be going on in Iraq for 10 or 15
years?
Which
he was wrong on the figures there, too.
That's right. So, yeah. Nor did he make the obvious point, which is assiduously avoided by U.S. media and government, that indeed it's the U.S. military that's been carrying on the operation in Colombia. It's not an anti-drugs program.
Yeah, and considering the stuff in the news about Colombia with the ELN, the other smaller rebel force, meeting with Uribe's, the government's representatives in Cuba, of all places, for negotiating something. They're more on the Venezuelan border than in the south. Uribe has also made an offer to the FARC to do some negotiations. It's low level. It's about swapping prisoners or something like that. But it's the first, it's an opening to negotiations. And it was mediated, apparently, by a three-country group that included France as the top liner. So these kind of things you would think would be unsettling in Foggy Bottom and Condi's place, that these kind of things are going ahead without, the U.S.'s role. At least that's, I haven't actually investigated enough to know, but that's my surmise, is that they're... the Venezuelan consul mentioned that, there's a lot of making of insults between Uribe and Chavez, but they actually cut a deal to put a pipeline across Colombia from Venezuela to the Pacific shore so that they can ship oil to China.
And
imagine what that
does in Washington. I mean, here, they thought they had nice, safe government, at least in Colombia, and now suddenly Colombian government is seeing a common interest with Venezuela to do the worst possible thing, that is to cut off the U.S. monopoly of world energy, the very monopoly that we use to control our capitalist rivals in the world, including rising China and rising India.
Yeah.
This is, it's a glorious sort of contradiction of American policy. It's incredible. The foreign press this week carried a story which I did not see in any of the American press. You're speaking of Foggy Bottom. Foggy Bottom was a section of Washington, D.C., where the State Department is now, and therefore it's sometimes used as a metonymy for the State Department. The story in the foreign press was that the State Department is taking over the control of reconstruction in Iraq from the Pentagon, and that this was done formally and directly this last week, moving the control of this from Rumsfeld to Rice. Now, don't know what that means, and as I say, it was only the foreign press that mentioned it. Maybe you saw it in the domestic press.
Begs the question that it was turned over to Condi when she was head of National Security Advisory some time ago.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And what happened there? It doesn't beg that question, Paul. That means something else, but it does raise that question.
The question.
Exactly, yeah. Look, the notion is, I mean, they got a tame general this week to say that they expect troop levels to drop next year. The administration is working desperately to be able to say before the 2006 elections that, see, we've stabilized things in Iraq and we're bringing our boys and girls home. Yeah, right. Now, they, of course, have no intention of leaving Iraq at all in any complete fashion, but they still want to be able to say it. And I think that's what's at stake in once again, as you say, given control of Iraq reconstruction to Condoleezza Rice.
Let's see. We got some nuggets here. The Irish mole.
This is
an amazing
story.
This
is quite an amazingly complex story, too. Yes.
Well, the gist of it is it was a black advance by the some level of British security forces had a mole inside the high-level command of Sinn Féin.
Sinn Féin, exactly.
And this is the guy that provided evidence that they were trying to try him for being a spy for Sinn Féin, or the IRA, in Stromont Castle. And this is what actually disrupted the working power sharing agreement.
That's right.
And it was made up. It was full cloth.
Britain pulled down the power sharing agreement on the grounds that an IRA or Sinn Féin spying operation was underway, and it turns out that the Secretary for Administration at Stormont was himself a British spy. And as you pointed out, Paul, from the accounts in the BBC and elsewhere, apparently the British had turned him originally by having compromised photographs or something like that.
Yeah.
Compromising photographs or something. So, I mean, it's a particularly, it's sordid at every level. And, worth thinking about in part as we watch the celebration of the Iraqi election. The parallels with what went on in Ireland are worth thinking about. I mean, everyone is saying, the American papers are saying, aha, Sunnis participated in the Iraqi election. Well, they haven't really noticed that their policy, the policy of the insurgency, is sort of the policy that the IRA had 15 years ago when they spoke of having the Armalite in one hand and the ballot box and the ballot in the other. This was a conscious policy, a direct policy of the IRA, and it seems exactly the policy that the insurgency is following in Iraq. The Bush government, in the meantime, is busily saying that, of course, this is Zarqawi and al-Qaeda that we're fighting in Iraq, and they have been defeated by the election. That's a fantasy. Even the American government recognizes that somewhere between 5% and 10% at most of the insurgency are foreign fighters. So the insurgency is in Iraq is a much more complex movement, which is by no means under the control of Zarqawi, even if he's alive and not a myth, or of Al Qaeda. And the U.S. Crowing about this election seems to me to be at best misplaced, and at worst what it really is, that is, propaganda.
Yeah, and one could draw out the analogy further, and it's speculative, but, you know, after our elections here, which have a lot to do with the drawdown and this stability, something will happen that'll throw it up in the air, and the U.S. will have to, intervene again. And of course, we can't bring as many back. And we might even have to send another 30,000 in or some such.
Well, and remember that it was clear there were no weapons of mass destruction and the war had been built entirely on lies, the Bush administration shifted to the fact, well, we're building democracy in the Middle East. That, too, of course, is a lie, but some funny things have been happening there recently, including election games for the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Hamas. Hamas has just swept the local elections in the West Bank. There's been a split in the Fatah party that the U.S. is relying on in Palestine, and it looks very much like the January elections for a Palestinian parliament will also show this advance on the part of Hamas. So the U.S. and Israel are very much worried about this, and so what we're hearing then is more and more saber rattling about attacks on Iran. The one thing that can put the neoliberal policies of Israel and the U.S. together is a common enemy, and Iran, thankfully, from their point of view, provides that.
And, well, with Sharon dropping in the polls all of a sudden again, though it's, again, probably within the margin of errors, he might have to pull something out
exactly.
of the box.
Exactly. That's the real worry.
Having some trouble, too, for in his internal. And for people that think that black advances and things like that can't be done, well, disabuse yourself. Have you heard of the Lavon affair?
Of the what affair?
Lavon affair, L-A-V-O-N. It was in the 50s.
Oh, yes, right.
I had never
Egyptian,
heard of it.
The Egyptian spy or the
Operation Susanna is another keyword in Egypt, you can search for it. It's actually attacks on U.S. and British targets by Mossad agents or people they recruited, mainly Sephardi Jews who were still living in Egypt, to provoke the U.S. And the British onto the side of the Israelis. And it maybe worked for the Brits because the Brits and French and Israelis joined in on the Suez attack. So,
well, we've heard in this country, I mean, several years ago, finally were revealed the plans for Operation Northwoods, where the U.S. would stage Remember the Maine type events in order to gin up reasons to attack Cuba. That is, they would stage operations that could be blamed on Cuban attacks on American interests or American facilities, and then an attack on Cuba. I mean, this was planning that was going on in the Pentagon. Now, there's no reason to believe this planning doesn't go all the time. In fact, one of the most shocking things I have read in a while on this is an article by Jorge Hirsch, H-I-R-S-H, who's been writing on these matters for a while, but he talks about American nuclear plans in the Persian Gulf and points to a presidential directive, NSPD 35, Nuclear Weapons Deployment Authorization, issued in May of 2004. He says this presidential directive, and we've been hearing about presidential directives, of course, this last week, this presidential directive is classified. It's secret. But he then sets out a very interesting scenario for the way in which nuclear weapons are being distributed around the Persian Gulf, with the idea that if something occurs, such as an Israeli attack on Iran, and Iran responds by, say, moving its army into southern Iraq, the U.S. will say, in lack of conventional
Game
forces,
over.
We have to use our tactical nuclear weapons in the Gulf. And what Hirsch has done here is set out, this is not Seymour Hirsch, this is Jorge Hirsch, has set out what we know about what the U.S. has planned in that area. This is very dangerous.
Where can one find that story?
That's on antiwar.com.
Hirsch
has done a number of these things, but this is quite a detailed analysis and, as I say, quite a disturbing one.
The late-breaking story I heard on the way over is that other people are, in the spirit of privatization, other people, Eberhoff was buying deregulation opinions from a Cato Institute guy named Bandow.
Yes.
Had to resign.
In disgrace, right.
And he also did a column, supposedly. 24 columns. I wonder what he got paid for 24 columns.
Yeah, I'd like to know, too. I'd like to be able to sell some columns.
Eberhoff's clients. Thanks for listening.
You won't be around next week, I guess?
That's true. The holiday. I'm going to be wassailing the rich, demanding rum and cake from their door. Like a great, reviving an old Christmas tradition from
Sounds
the Dickensian
good.
Time of in England, I guess.
Find some Hinwees someplace.
Shaking down the rich.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Merry Christmas to you, and,
Happy holidays.
Inshallah, we'll be back
like
here.
That.
Yes. Oh, you're so correct. Inshallah, we'll be back here again after Christmas. Take care.